From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And today we're going to be talking about sports. My guest is Shakia Taylor. She's a baseball historian with a specialty in women and African Americans in the game. She's also a senior editor and writer at the Chicago Tribune, where her work examines the intersection of sports and culture. Another news outlet, the Chicago Reader, recently called her the best Chicago daily sports journalist. Taylor is going to be heading downstate March 28th and 29th for an event from the Humanities Research Institute at the University of Illinois Urbana. It's called Sporting Publics, and it's going to be about the ways athletes can help us shine a light on problems in our society. Her event and most others are open to the public. We'll have more information on our website, 21stshow.org. For now, Shakia Taylor, welcome to the 21st Show. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I want to start with a question about video games. What are hair dynamics?
I learned about this very recently myself. And hair dynamics are the way the hair looks in the game, the way it looks, the way it moves, the way it flows, the texture, the details. Had no idea that even went into video games.
Yeah. Is it a helmet or does it actually flow? Why is this important, right? Why were they introduced to the big baseball game this year?
Hair dynamics were introduced into this year's edition of MLB The Show, with Tony Stone being added to the game as part of the Negro League storyline season two. She is the first woman to play in a men's pro league and now the first woman to play in a men's pro league baseball game.
Yeah, what can you tell her about us? You recently wrote about her in the Tribune and through her appearance in this video game.
Oh, yeah. So like I said, Toni was the first woman to play in a men's pro league. She played for the Indianapolis Clowns in 1953. She replaced someone many of us know, Hank Aaron, as he is known, as their second baseman. She had to kind of figure it out on her own as the first woman and only woman at that time to play. She ended up only playing two seasons in the Negro American League, but they were two pretty good seasons. The Tribune said that she was valuable to her team, which is not something I expected to hear, because you hear so much that she was more of a novelty, you know, just getting people to come see a girl play, so to speak. So she was a tremendous woman who is more of an unknown pioneer, one of those footnotes in baseball history who's starting to get some real serious attention now.
Yeah, what are the value, do you think, of these the storylines feature in this video game, for example, and bringing these stories to a wider audience?
First, I think there's tremendous value in putting something historical like this in a video game. You always hear from people that they think their kids or, you know, other adults waste time playing video games. And it's such, you know, it's not this, you're not learning from it. It's not educational. What skills are you picking up? But something like this goes against that. It's inserted into a game. It's documentary style, but you're playing. And so I think with the way Negro Leagues history has been sort of buried over time, in kind of a way in that so few people know about it, those who do hold on to it and just really want to share it, this brings it in a new way to an entirely new generation. And to a certain degree, not a new generation. There are some older people who play video games who aren't aware of this. So I think it's just bringing another part of baseball history to light. And this is American history, so it's for all of us. And I think that's a tremendous move by both Sony and MLB, well, I should say, and, you know, the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, where Bob Kendrick is doing a tremendous job in making that history accessible.
You've talked many times about growing up as a baseball fan in Ohio when the Cleveland Guardians, then known as the Indians, were a strong team. Were you always interested, though, in the history side of baseball?
I've always been interested in history generally. I can't really pinpoint a moment, but I've always been a question asker. My dad told me a story recently about we were on a road trip that was about 4 hours long and I would not stop talking. And I was probably about 11 or 12 years old at that time. And it's because I'm curious. I think that's the root of everything I write, is I always want to know how. I want to know the nuts and bolts. I want to know, who had the idea first? What inspired the idea? What were you doing when you got the idea? What was happening around you when you got the idea? I think history is so important, that it's just been an interest of mine in every way. And I think in sport, it's even more important, simply because it makes it fun. It gives an interesting angle. We learn about pioneers. We make connections to real life that maybe we didn't realize were there. History is always happening around us. So my interest started really young, and sport is just where it blossomed.
I want to go back to Toni Stone, who we were just talking about a minute ago. You, in your piece, you have a screen grab, I guess, screen grab, like a clip from the 1953 Chicago Daily Tribune. The headline was "Girl to Play for Clowns Today." Okay, that sounds incredibly sexist to modern ears. I'm guessing you could find a dozen other equally or more sexist things in a newspaper of that era, probably racist too. I wonder what it's like for you steeping yourself in this history.
Sometimes I read things like that, and that headline is a wonderful example, because I wonder if it was meant to sound that way, right? I wonder if we're just reading it in present day ears or with present day understanding. Because if you look, deeper into the piece, they praise her. They say positive things about her. And a big part of me as a Black woman digging into these types of things in history is I have to sort of remove myself from the story, right? Like I can look at it with my own experience or with my own informed perspective, but I try not to take it personally. I try to keep everything in its time. If something like that was printed today, we'd be like, what? Why would you call a grown woman a girl, right? But in that time, she was 21, according to the piece. And maybe that was the way, people were addressed then. I personally know I still call people girl all the time. So I was trying not to look at it from the this is a negative way. I really thought it was cool, first of all, that she had a mention in the Tribune in 1953. Huge. Because so much of Black baseball history wasn't in major newspapers. It wasn't in mainstream news. You find it more in smaller regional newspapers, in the Black press. And a lot of those places no longer exist. And it takes more digging. We're talking about a time where folks were documenting history while they were being ignored. So I think the meaning of that clip is so much deeper than the headline.
Well, this actually dovetails nicely with something else I wanted to ask you about, which is your work with the Society for American Baseball Research's Negro Leagues and Teams Committee. This is ongoing work to decide which leagues from the segregated era of baseball should be considered major leagues. I guess, first off, why is that important?
Well, the research itself is important in that so many things that happened in the past are sort of being disregarded. And I think the Negro Leagues is an example of that. If we don't work to preserve that history, if we don't work to kind of shove it forward, to kind of put it in the eyes of those who need to see it, it disappears. We can't just hold it in our memory. But I also think it's righting some wrongs there. I think this idea that Major League Baseball was the only professional baseball league that matters, it's something that needed to be addressed. I'm not sure how I feel entirely about the thing that took it out also being the thing that tries to bring it back. But I think it's very important work from a research side. I think it's very important work from a history side. I think that the people who are involved, because there's more than, like, there's this larger committee and then it's broken down into multiple groups, right? So there's a lot of thought and time and effort and math being put into what this all means, and where it should be. And I don't like to use the term elevate, but in a sense, it does elevate it if you think of it, and it's just bringing it forward. It's showing the talent that existed in these leagues. It's showing this wasn't a lesser type of baseball. This was just baseball. The people look different. They may have sounded a little different. They may have been from different parts of the country, but it was still very good baseball. There were some very talented people playing, both, you know, men and women. And this honors them. When you talk to people who lived during the times of the Negro Leagues, because this wasn't that long ago, when we talk about it, it comes up as if this happened hundreds of years ago. Sure, the beginning of it was hundreds of years ago, but not the end. We're talking about Tony Stone playing in 1953. So that wasn't that long ago. Many of us have family members who were kids or adults at that time. So this is very recent history that we're trying to help bring forward for a new generation, that we're trying to connect some dots for people. You hear about Jackie Robinson reintegrating Major League Baseball, but it's like things happened before that. There was Black baseball before that. So I think this kind of just brings all of that forward.
You mentioned math in there. I don't know how you feel about the term, you know, stats nerd or baseball nerd, but can you talk about the math aspect of this work?
First of all, I think being called a nerd is a compliment.
Amen.
I don't think it can be negative at all, because I think nerd is more an indication of your passion for something. It's how into it you are, how willing you are to sort of get in the muck of it. And so stats nerds in baseball, they're necessary. I know people love to diss the stats nerds. They love to say that, you know, nerds are ruining sports analytics. But to a certain degree, it gives us a greater understanding of what happened. You can look at someone and be like, yeah, he's mashing. But a stats nerd is going to be like, not only is he mashing, but these are the numbers to support that. I think the things can be married. The two ideas can go together. So when I say math with regard to the Negro Leagues committees, I'm saying these are people who are looking at where the teams were in their respective standings at that time, how they were hitting, who was hitting, what was going on. I personally do not consider myself to be that deep of a stats nerd. I have a more general understanding, but I am a part of the conversations and I am on the email threads and I have seen the Excel spreadsheets, and these people are working. There's a lot of math happening there that even I'm catching up on or trying to make sure that I understand, but it contextualizes things, the math part. Like, yeah. You know, there's support for what you're saying. It's like a few years ago, I thought it would be a fun idea around the World Series to attack the idea that Reggie Jackson was clutch. Right? Like, we love to call things clutch. We see something a few times, we see a guy hit a couple shots in the fourth quarter and it's necessary. And we're like, oh, he's so clutch. But then I wanted to know, was that real? Does the math support that? Do the numbers support that? And what I learned in the process is like, yes, sometimes the math supports it, but most times it doesn't, but that doesn't make it less fun. Yeah, stats nerd, definitely a compliment.
Don't sell yourself short because, 2 minutes until we need to take a break. But I also wanted to ask you, on this point, should more baseball players be wearing blue do-rags?
Yes.
Maybe
I'm not even going to qualify.
You can explain.
No, just leave it like that.
All right. Well, I'm going to help our listeners a little bit. Google Shakia Taylor, Marcus Stroman. And you will see why that is a fun thing to explore. All right, we're going to take a break. Let me invite listeners to join our conversation today at 800-222-9455. What do you know about this history? What do you think should be known about this history? Again, 800-222-9455. We're going to have more with Shakia Taylor, who is a senior editor at the Chicago Tribune. She writes about sports and culture. We're also going to be talking about some sports media when we get back, movies, TV shows, maybe a little bit about the women's basketball and the NCAAs. That's all coming up after a short break here on the 21st show. I do also want to encourage you to, we have some coverage coming up of the eclipse in Southern Illinois. If you have plans to go to that, do get in touch. You can do that through our website, 21stshow.org. We'd love to include your voice in a future conversation. All right, enough from me. We need to take a break. More when we come back. Stay here. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking with Shakia Taylor, who's the senior editor at the Chicago Tribune, writes about sports and culture. She's going to be coming downstate later this month for an event sponsored by the Humanities Research Institute at the U of I. It's called Sporting Publics, meant to look at the ways sports can help us think about and talk about problems in our society, past and present. This is taking place March 28th and 29th. More information on our website, 21stshow.org. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455 is the number. All right, Shakia, I mentioned this symposium, fancy word for it, coming up later this month. You know, I did want to ask you on a more serious note. There is a long history of athletes using their celebrity to call attention to issues in society, right? From Tommy Smith and John Carlos to Colin Kaepernick. You know how these stories often turn out. I did want to ask you, what did you first think when you heard about Kaepernick back in September 2016?
Oh my goodness, that was so long ago. Wow, 2016.
I know, right? I was surprised too.
I honestly don't remember what I thought. That was so long ago. I do know that I think protest is important. And I probably thought that at the time, that, you know, protest is important and his right to protest was important. But I cannot recall what I was thinking in that moment.
Well, then I guess I know what you would say. I mean, you do often hear, I did want to ask you, you hear this strain among some pundits in sports and politics who say, you know, shut up and play, shut up and dribble, whatever it is. I wonder what, you know, what you think of that, given your knowledge of the history of protest in sports and the, you know, the work that people had to put in over many years.
I think people say shut up and play or shut up and dribble only when they disagree, because when someone says something they agree with, obviously they want them to say it more, right? So I may not agree with everything an athlete has to say, but I absolutely support their right to say it. And so I think shut up and dribble and shut up and play, it's reductive. These are still humans. They participate in our society, in many ways, right? They vote, they drive our roads, they have children who go to school. So things that impact regular people also impact them in a lot of ways. And I also think that if you have a platform of any kind, and you want to use it to express how you feel about humanity or how you feel about certain issues, that is absolutely something you should be able to do. But I do want to say that, you know, having the right to say something does not mean that you can say it without consequence or without someone saying, you know, something in return. But I am fully behind athletes participating in society. That is what protest is. That is what speaking out is. It is participating in society.
All right. I want to spend some time talking about contemporary sports and things that are happening now. You were at Welsh Ryan Arena in January when Caitlin Clark and the Iowa basketball team just destroyed the Wildcats. I think it was 110-74. I want to ask you, not only was it what was it like watching Clark play, but what was it like watching the fans watch her play?
Well, watching Caitlin Clark is always a treat. I actually got to see her last year when I traveled to Dallas for the Women's Final Four. I was in person for what kicked off a year of everyone talking about Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese. And seeing her at Northwestern, it was no different. Iowa fans, they travel very well. Chicago obviously is a big place for Iowa fans, and Evanston is just up the road. So it was packed. There were people in line hours and hours before she was supposed to be there. I think I mentioned in my column that, you know, one fan was like, she's like the Beatles. What a comparison, particularly for a woman in sports, you know, to get that sort of crowd and have it everywhere. And, you know, people come not just to see her, sometimes they come to root against her. I think that's important to note. You know, there were a few people who made sure to email me after that to let me know, like, yeah, I was there, but I was there to be a hater. So, like, respect to all the haters out there too. But no, she drew a big crowd. There were lots of young children. A lot of the focus is always on young women and girls and, you know, all of that. And I think that's great. But I think what's important is that it was children generally, regardless of gender, regardless of age. They were there rooting. They were there wanting to see this young woman play at her best. And I think they got to. It was a really nice crowd. One of my favorite things I overheard at the game, and I will never say who said it, but someone was like, this is great. The beer lines are short because everyone here to root for her is underage. And like, it was a fun environment though. Until the route was on. For a little while, her shots weren't, you know, hitting. And Northwestern was double teaming her pretty good. And they had her hanging out behind the 3-point line and she wasn't really getting anything. And then Lisa Bluter calls a timeout. And I'm assuming that she told Caitlin Clark, get in the paint, you know, get in the paint, get a body. And those shots started falling. And the next thing you know, it was like, oh, man, that got out of hand very quickly. But that's the impact she can have on a game. You can only keep her out of it for so long.
Yeah, no one wants to see their team lose by 36 points, even if it is against a celebrity athlete on the other side. So Clark is turning pro. The WNBA players, you know, they are said to not make very good money, at least when compared to their counterparts in the, what do we say, the MNBA. you have written about this idea that Clark might, you know, people say, oh, she's going to be taking a pay cut to go pro. Why are they wrong?
Well, they're wrong in their understanding of NIL, period. I think
name, image, and likeness, the sort of sponsorship deals that college athletes can get. Yeah,
exactly. I think there's this idea because men's sports, particularly football and basketball, were more prominent in the media. And there were things that, you know, we heard about the most and we hear from those coaches the most about the players getting money and these collectives that we used to know as boosters, being able to pay into it and pay for play, pay for on-court performance. That doesn't exist in women's sports. Also, an NIL valuation is not based on a dollar amount that a player is actively receiving. It's basically like your influencer number, how much the number of followers you have across your social media accounts are valued. If you look at that list, Caitlin Clark isn't even in the top 10, not even close. I think she might be in the top 30. And so that's important too, is we're not seeing a real number. We're seeing a guess. We're seeing an estimation. We're seeing this is what it could be. And there's no collective for her in women's sports. She hasn't taken any money from it. So I say all that to say, it's not a pay cut when you're not getting a salary. She's only going to get more money. I don't understand how you can think of that as a pay cut. If you're getting money now, and then next year you'll get more money on top of the money that you're getting now, a pay cut doesn't even sound like the thing that's happening. Right. It may not be that her salary, you know, obviously isn't in the millions of dollars. That's not where WNBA salaries are. In fact, her salary is going to be less than what many people, I should say some people, make a year doing whatever their, quote, regular job is. Because the first year, I think she'll be getting less than 80,000. It's somewhere around 76,000. But again, more money cannot be counted as less. So there you go. No pay cut at all when you're just getting $80,000 more on top of whatever you're getting. And those endorsements, those name, image, likeness deals, those influencer deals, like your State Farm and Gatorade and H&R Block and whatever else. And I think she's going to be with Nike. That can only get bigger. She's obviously going to get a signature shoe. It's got to be on the way at this point. The girl's selling out arenas at 22.
Amazing. You know, I feel like I've heard this a number of times in my life, especially in the past decade or two, that, you know, we're on the cusp of women's professional sports kind of reaching a new level of popularity in America. And yet it's been this slow ratcheting up. What do you think about that? What do you think it's going to take? Is it even possible for that to happen, given the, you know, century plus head start that men's sports has?
Well, I think there are a number of factors that impact the trajectory of women's sports from a popularity standpoint. Do I think women's sports are very popular right now? Absolutely. I think we will be there, though, when we stop having to say the word women in front of sports. I think there right now is still this need to separate, to think of them differently. I kind of alluded to this in one of our earlier questions here, but I think with women's sports, the idea that you're doing it for the young girls and, you know, you want young girls to know that they can do this, it's very noble and it's very sweet, but also little girls today have been alive for Title IX. They know that they can play sports. So I think what needs to happen is getting out of the scarcity mindset will be important. It'll impact everything. I also think not hyper-focusing on whether or not men believe in the game or whether or not men know the game or support it in any way. Because, and I use this in basketball context a lot, but like hoopers like hoop. It does not matter who is actually holding the ball, right? And once we get to that aspect, once we get to that point, I think everything grows. I also think the powers that be in women's sports, regardless of league, regardless of whether it's pro or college, I think those people have to be wanting it. They have to want to push it forward. They have to want to grow the game culturally, grow the game across, is super important. So there's, like I said, there are a lot of factors that go into whether or not women's sports will be where its fans would like it to be. But I do think there's some serious momentum right now.
All right, just a few minutes left in our time together. This weekend is Selection Sunday for the NCAA tournament. Which Illinois teams do you have your eye on?
Well, I've been the Tribune's Loyola Chicago writer for about the last month here. And they've got a really fun story going on up there with head coach Drew Valentine and those guys going from last place in their first season in the Atlantic 10 Conference to a share of the regular season conference title, and the potential for a bid in the tournament. I think Northwestern is looking very interesting, right? Because Boo Booey, what's going to happen with Boo Booey? Is this the year that they get something done? I've been looking at Illinois too. I know there are people listening who are like, don't you get on here and not talk about U of I. I've been looking at Illinois too. I'm wondering how they're going to do. I'm wondering how strong they're going to come, with any sort of tournament bid, but also where these teams are going to land in the bracket is really important too. Like, are there going to be any meaningful matchups? I'm really looking forward to Sunday. If you can't tell, I've been like studying because I got to work this weekend and keep up with all of these teams and know what's happening. So what would be really fun is for all three teams to just shock us all for a bit. It might make work a little longer and a little more difficult, but I'm ready. It's March.
What is that like, immersing yourself in a beat like this? You mentioned you've been doing Loyola for the past month. I mean, obviously you bring a tremendous amount of background knowledge to this, but maybe you can just talk briefly about, getting up to speed and what that's been like.
Oh man, one of my favorite parts of the job is that I'm not married to a particular beat. You know, most sports writers, as we know it, you associate them with a team. You read them because they cover a specific team that you follow or maybe you're relatively interested in. With me, I get to parachute in, hang out with a team, get as deep into the weeds as I want and write stories on it. So I'm bringing a new perspective because I'm not the person who's there all the time. Like, you'd be surprised at what you miss because you're looking at it always. It's like when I'm writing a story, if I get stuck, I get up and walk away, go do something else, push it down in my mind, come back, boom, the idea is a little more developed. It's pretty much the same idea. So I spend a ton of time researching. I read other people's work. I am indebted to other writers for their, hard work and research and stat keeping. I like to go back and read profiles on the players and the coaches and anybody related to the team, just to sort of feel the vibe. You don't hear too many writers say that, but that's kind of what I get to do. I get to come in, feel the vibe, and talk about what that is like.
Shakia Taylor is a deputy senior content editor, very long title, at the Chicago Tribune. The Chicago Reader just last month called her the best Chicago daily sports journalist. She's going to be in Urbana, Illinois, March 28th and 29th for an event called Sporting Publix. More information about that on our website, 21stshow.org. Shakia Taylor, what a fun conversation. Thanks so much for making time for us today on the 21st Show.
Thank you for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Coming up after the break, we're going to be listening back to my conversation with the documentary director, Joey Jacoby, about her film on Candace Parker, Illinois-born and bred basketball great. I also do want to do an editor's note from a conversation we had yesterday about a book, DIY book promo. Our guest mentioned the Report for America program. I should say the 21st Show, our partner station, Northern Public Radio, WNIJ, is part of that program, but our producing station, Illinois Public Media, is not part of Report for America. So there you have it. More to come here on the 21st Show after a short break. Stay with us.